Hi, my name is Casey Must. I'm the owner and founder of Citizen Yoga, and you are listening to our podcast, After Class. After Class is our platform where we get to talk to mental health professionals, students, teachers, anybody in the community who is also trying to further the mission of improving mental health and preventing suicide. I'm extremely, extremely excited to have one of my closest friends on our podcast who you've heard me reference many times in philosophy, if you've been in philosophy. And we've been podcasting, as we have decided, and we will say, since we were 18 years old, though our podcasts were on long walks in Evanston, our conversations through grad school, many other long conversations throughout transitions in our lives about our personal healing. And we both into the healing realm, and not just personally, but also trying to help other people who surround us. So I'm so grateful and so honored to have Jen as our podcast guest today. I guess I should call you like doctor. Should I call you like doctor? Dr. Jen?
Sure.
Armakin? Doctor.
Sure, that is my name.
Doctor. Tell us about how about we start with your mission?
My mission.
Yeah,
I like
What's
it.
What's your mission?
Well, my mission, Casey, is really to connect. I mean, I am, I'm a licensed clinical psychologist. I am newly sober about a year ago. I am a mom. I am a partner. I am someone who I think at this point has decided to and is like really learning to stay with my whole self. And so, you know, prior to the pandemic, I would say I had, you know, my private practice, I had my three young children. I was doing a lot. I was working really hard, as a psychologist that specializes in treating folks with, trauma related conditions. When we experienced the collective trauma of the pandemic, everything changed. And my approach to healing and working with folks and really working with myself changed. And so out of that was born ECHO, which is our interdependent mental health practice here in the DC area that I can tell you more about if you're interested.
I love it. So in terms of... You just mentioned, which part of it, we will get it deeper into this conversation, but you said, you mentioned being newly sober. Maybe we should just go in now, but what was that choice, and why is that important for you to mention on the podcast? Because I think that people will be surprised about, like, I know your journey, but I think it's a different journey than maybe what other people have. And it's an inspiring choice.
Yeah. So, you know, sobriety for me is about staying with myself and my whole self. It's about staying connected to what's true and what's real. That decision happened for me, and this is, sobriety from alcohol. It happened basically on January 6th, January 7th. And yes, it was about the insurrection, but it was really about an end to this disembodiment, disconnection, numbing that I was living in. That was, you know, alcohol played a big role in that, but it was also being a, you know, mom of three, working in a pandemic as a psychologist who works with folks that are, you know, there's a range, but a good number of my clients were in crisis, and a good number of my colleagues and my, you know, were struggling. And I would say for me, my struggle did not show up in the form of, you know, severe depression or needing to go into like to rehab, or in many ways, it wasn't observable. It was very internal, I would say spiritual. And, you know, part of the way that I managed the stress of that chapter, you know, of life, was every night I would drink wine, and a couple glasses of wine, you know, I would say the disruption was, so the amount of wine, it wasn't like I was passing out every night or anything like that, but over time it, you know, disrupted my sleep, it increased my anxiety. And there was no recovery. There was no, space for my body mm-hmm. or my mind or my spirit to reset. And so, you know, I think, mm-hmm. So yeah, that was the choice. And in many ways it felt, beyond a choice. It felt like it came from like somewhere else, right? Like a knowing inside. Mm-hmm. And I linked in the recognition that morning, the next morning after the sixth was, first of all, just like knowing that I had to do something different to participate in what, in the world around me in a more true way, in a more whole way. But also linking how white supremacy culture, how the collective trauma, you know, and the various ways that we dehumanize each other, as a society was directly linked to, how I was treating myself. Like there was a form of dehumanization that I was engaging in. Right. And, the drinking, you know, was becoming a problem.
It's interesting. Cause, you know, obviously I've known you forever, and, you and I had a conversation a few days prior. I think I was visiting you. I visited Jen on New Year's that like 5 days beforehand. And, you know, we had a conversation in passing about alcohol and during the pandemic for myself, because I was facing so much stress and strain and mm-hmm. my own, I wouldn't say depression, but massive amount of anxiety around the pandemic and running Citizen and managing 100 people through a pandemic and et cetera, that I had chosen to stop drinking mm-hmm. as well. And it was, you know, I remember when you called me and you were like, okay, this is a decision that I've made and I really, you know, I'm sticking to it. And I'm like, great. Like, you know, I think that one of the things we had referenced at that point was how often society tells us that drinking wine, that's just a part of mom life, mm-hmm. you know, or drinking beer or any kind of drinking leads to a greater sense of social connection, mm-hmm. which it does actually for in a lot of ways that society is really driving our value system. And I think that when we want to heal or change something in society, we have to become conscious, active people mm-hmm. in society, not letting society to driving us as much, but us making our own conscious choices. Mm-hmm. And I think that to me, when I reflect on your decision, and I guess my own decision as well, though I wouldn't necessarily call myself sober, mm-hmm. Though I don't drink right now. I think that was one of the things that really mm-hmm. we spoke about. And one of the phrases you used when we were having this conversation was, you know, if we want to take down the patriarchy, but if we want to make good change, if we want to make impactful, like movement, to my sirens, only in DC, not in Michigan, in terms of human rights, we have to become more sober mm-hmm. in our thinking, in our connecting, in our mm-hmm. consciousness.
Yeah.
So those were some of the takeaways from your decision, which were different reasons than my decision.
Yeah.
But that's what I sort of combed through. I don't know if you would have anything else to add to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think there is something, I don't know, rebellious or counterculture to not drink. And there's also there is a slowing down, and this is, you know, part of, I think therapy can bring us into this, yoga can bring us into this, lots of different practices, of just, you know, being more present to what is real and overriding that impulse to kind of just go along with the habitual status quo or the thing that, you know, we just have become so accustomed to doing. And I think at that time, you know, we were 4 years into Trump's presidency, a year into the pandemic about, the fatigue, the burnout. And I will say, you know, the other just, I think, significant component to it is that, as someone who, you know, my ancestors are, of European descent, of African descent, of, indigenous descent, Panamanian, Latina, also, I think just being someone who both passes as white and is not white, someone who is married to a man and also identifies as queer, somebody who has, you know, a PhD and also very much, you know, what do I say? I appreciate the academic part of my, you know, my life, mm-hmm. my training, my experience. But I would say, like, a lot of what makes my practice effective is intuitive, is not necessarily what I learned, you know, and this is not to discredit the evidence-based practice or, you know, anything from my profession, but it's, I guess I just, the other, and bringing this in, is that labels and certainly binaries, like, have never worked for me. They don't resonate. They don't fit. And so I use the word sober because I think it's about the energy of clarity and truth and staying present. And I know, I believe, you know, working in this space also, again, as a provider, as a mental health provider, psychologist who also works with folks with co-occurring substance use disorder. When you work with trauma, you work with addiction, right? They go hand in hand. But it's so important that my patients, my clients, you know, identify, define, like, using their language, their words, like, what sober means to them, right? If that is a word that resonates, or recovery, or, you know, their mental health journey, their healing, their language matters, because it's, you know, we kind of that expression is important and is a big part of the healing.
Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting. And I love that you sort of brought that in, because when you do say sober, and, like, for me, I don't know if I, like what I said, I don't know if I would identify it mm-hmm. as that, but mm-hmm. I also think that part of my healing journey, you know, Jen obviously knows everything about me pretty much more than most people, maybe besides Adam. I think that not going so binary in healing, mm-hmm. not saying I am this or I'm not this, I think mm-hmm. that was a huge part of my own personal recovery in my 30s. And, you know, not drinking, I don't necessarily say I'm sober, but I also know that it's an important distinction of how I am choosing to treat my body and treat myself. And mm-hmm. it's not because I had a problem with alcohol. And, you know, again, from the outside, I could never say this to you, but I didn't really see alcohol as something that was, it wasn't disrupting your life from the outside, mm-hmm. right? And I think that that's where we can revolutionize our own healing journeys, is it's not about just the disruption mm-hmm. from your job. Like, mm-hmm. I think that when we think we have a problem with something or we're choosing a healing journey, it has to, like, that means we've had to massively disrupt something. It's right. Like, no, as we get further down the healing journey, it's a fine, like, refinement or a tuning in so subtly to what we're mm-hmm. trying to actually accomplish in our own selves and the clarity of who we are. Mm-hmm. So I can appreciate that. And I encourage people listening, you know, if you make this decision, I always tell Jen, like, I don't tell people when I'm making decisions about my own mental health or my own physical health. One, I find that it creates a lot of internal pressure. So then I don't know, I guess, like, we're talking around something on purpose, but I hope that this message comes through, which is you don't have to tell somebody that you've got sober, though Jen saying it is very healing. It was healing mm-hmm. for me because it put more words into and more thought into, mm-hmm. well, why I had already made that decision. Mm-hmm. The reason that she made the decision is actually different than why I made the decision, but then mm-hmm. it expanded my definition of what mm-hmm. sobriety meant. Mm-hmm. So I encourage all of us listening to not just put these things into terms, but definitely become conscious about what you're choosing, which is really so interesting.
Yeah.
When we talk about mental health, can we define mental health? Because mm-hmm. it's a term that I use a lot, but mm-hmm. it's always funny because it's like, well, why are we a yoga studio that stood for mental health? Mm-hmm. This was so strange 9 years ago mm-hmm. or 10 years ago almost mm-hmm. now that we opened and we were like, oh, we're for suicide prevention and mental health. And people mm-hmm. were like, huh? Like, you mean mm-hmm. yoga's for a spiritual journey? And it's like, to me, mm-hmm. there's no difference between your mental yeah. health and your spiritual journey. Yeah. But I'm curious, since you are the professional, that we're both professionals.
Yeah, we are both professionals.
What,
yeah.
What is mental health? Like, how would you define yeah. that for people?
It's a really, really good question. I am using that term less myself because I think part of the limitation is that it excludes the body when we think of mental health. It's sort of, we think of the mind. So it can exclude sort of what we call like the physical. And it also excludes the collective. Maybe it doesn't exclude it, but I find that word, if we're bringing in, what we use is embodied collective healing to bring. Yes, we are talking about bringing, symptoms associated with cognitions, thoughts, emotions, feelings, behaviors, which could be, looking like a number of different things, as well as relationships, right? But those, the pathology in those domains, yes, they may meet criteria for a mental health disorder in the diagnostic, criteria, but that if we're thinking about, intervention or treatment or prevention, the pathology exists outside of the individual, right? Also. And so, I guess, you asked me to define mental health, which I can try to do. but I guess within the definition, I want to bring in the whole body, which is going to also be the spirit, and I want to bring in the collective body, which is how we, relate as beings, and how we, it's not just about function. It's about, being, if we talk about like kind of thriving interdependently, it's that just, having a set of symptoms reduced, when an individual comes in to treat their mental health issues, those symptoms are reduced, but that alone is not the answer. We were talking about self-care earlier. That's a huge piece of the puzzle, but we have to also, and the work that, I try to do with my clients is bring people, yes, into more of a sense of, functioning and well-being, but also applying that into their relational lives and applying that into the, how they engage with the collective, whatever that might be, right? In the, their relationships, their work life, et cetera. Casey, did I answer your question on how do I define mental health?
I think that one of the things that you're saying is that it's a whole body health versus just like you go into therapy and you're sitting there and talking, yeah. but it's also like how you connect to your physical form. It's how you, I know that you, use breathing. It's how you're defining the mind or working with the mind, but then there's an interrelatedness to mental health that I think is missed, that yeah. the whole point of mental health is then collective health.
Exactly.
Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say, to me, the conversation around mental health and inclusion are one and the same. So if we're talking about, how do we create the conditions that allow people to be well, to thrive, to have, to move towards more liberation, more co-creation. It's the same exact conversation about inclusion and equity. It's the exact conversation about belonging, right? Mm-hmm. It's the same. And so a big part of that is, one, people need to feel safe and be safe, right? If they're without safety, we can't co-create. We can't, certainly can't thrive. We are in the trauma responses of fight, of flight, of freeze, of shutdown. We're just not even together, right? So safety is the first piece of that, right? And then there is a pace. I think earlier when we were chatting, you know, again about self-care, there's a pace and a spaciousness that we need to also bring into the way we connect again with ourselves and each other. And then, you know, I think another big piece of mental health and inclusion is, how do we repair? How do we recover? How do we address, reprocess, you know, speak truth, listen, you know, build capacity for the discomfort of, the pain, right? The pain, mm-hmm. the, harm that's been caused. You know, so it's all the same conversation, mental health, inclusion, belonging.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that you had mentioned is just this idea that, you know, if you want to start your mental health journey, you have to find the places, or the, you know, what we could call it, like whole health journey, you mm-hmm. know, is, you know, where are we lacking connection? Mm-hmm. You know, and very inherently society has created this all of mm-hmm. us. And I don't just mean in gender, in race, you know, even mm-hmm. just in like the success of technology, which is not the primary purpose of this conversation, but the success of technology is connection, and its mm-hmm. essence is disconnection.
Exactly.
You know, when Jen and I were in college, I think it was like right when cell phones had just come out, I actually found my paper that I wrote on like the paradox of a cell phone. Like, and how much I hated
Amazing.
Cell phones back then.
I love
like
it.
How it was, yeah. It's just like, okay, we saw the writing on the wall of this, mm-hmm. you know, disconnection mm-hmm. that was it was going to create for all of us. But you had mentioned, like, when we're on a mental health journey, we have to locate, you know, where we can connect more deeply. And one of the things you just mentioned is like, well, then we have to create space to hold the pain that we have yes. also experienced in the past.
Yes.
So what do you really mean by that? Or what has that meant for you? Maybe that's an mm-hmm. easier way, because then people could practically apply it to themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What has it meant for you to like connect yeah. to yourself? But really that meant that you had to connect to more pain, which I know some of yeah. those examples, but.
Yeah. Yeah. Big question. Yeah. So, I mean, I think one huge element of it is slowing down. And I know I look like I'm slow, like I speak sort of slowly. I tend to kind of be thoughtful, but inside, part of like the result of developmental trauma for me is like this, a very, very busy mind, and sometimes kind of, you know, anxiety, tension. There is a lot of activation that I mask, right? And so giving myself the space and time to notice, I mean, a lot of, I think you're kind of asking, what are the pathways or you know, what has worked for me in terms of my own healing, and how I build capacity to hold pain or sit with it or build sort of, yeah, I talk about the window of tolerance a lot. And so it's sort of expanding the window of tolerance to ride the waves, the ups and the downs. You know,
what did you have to like, because they don't know you, and I know,
yeah.
I know you for you recently or in the past 10 years or beyond, like, what are some of the topics because somebody would have to figure out, well, what topic for me is sort of like part of my pain body that maybe I didn't even realize was a pain body. So do you have, like, what are some of the places in your life that you have had to recognize as a source of pain that maybe you didn't realize, and then expand, one, the place to hold and be with it, but then to also then at the same time expand that place of tolerance? You think of those?
Well, I guess I can try to wind the tape all the way back. I mean, I was born, in the mid 80s. And at the time, my father was the ambassador of Panama to the US, or to the OAS. And my mom was a aerospace engineer. And there was a tremendous amount of stress, I think, in utero that I experienced in my, you know, that level of development. My parents, the U.S. actually invaded Panama when my dad was in office. And so there was a, you know, somewhat similar to the, you know, the insurrection, right? There was a collective trauma that existed and very directly affected my family, that coincided with the, end of their marriage and, you know, and subsequently, you know, my father moving back to Panama and, you know, primarily being raised by a single mom, who's white. And I think in many ways, just she's white. She's, again, she's an aerospace engineer. She's brilliant. And she, is a survivor herself. And so, you know, I think a lot of my kind of emotional needs were not really met, and navigating who I was, who I am, was something, it was kind of an independent exercise, you know, I had to figure it out for myself in a lot of ways. I had both, you know, privilege in terms of, you know, going to good schools and, you know, economic stability and, you know, a lot of opportunities, in terms of, you know, being, having access. You know, I was actually just talking with a colleague this week about just the protective factor of sports for me. You know, being able to play on certain teams that, you know, brought me into embodiment, brought me into connection, right? That was sort of my first exposure to embodied collective healing, being on, you know, soccer teams and basketball teams and things like that. But in terms of like what were the pain points, I call it developmental trauma, but I think, it's a combination of things that should have happened that didn't happen, you know, in my formation, and things that shouldn't have happened that did happen. So, you know, there's a lot to that story, which I feel like I'm giving you enough to.
No, you are.
Yeah.
But I'm think go ahead. Just saying that exact thing, like, okay, well, where in our lives do things that shouldn't have happened happen, and where in our lives did things not happen that needed to happen?
Yeah.
I mean, that really is our development, you know, and that's where we get stuck. Everyone, all of us get stuck. And I think that is part of our mental health work, our embodied work, is to figure out, well, when your needs aren't met, it's painful. So whether needs not being met is something big, like your gender not being recognized, or, you know, your skin color not being recognized, or the opposite, not even not being recognized, ignored, or the opposite, hated, or, you know, parts of you shut down.
Sure.
And that shutdown doesn't just happen individually. That shutdown has happened, you know, socially and societally in a much bigger way. That's where the power, I mean, Jen and I had many conversations, and, you know, as coddling as Jen can be to me and I to her, during the resurgence of Black Lives Matter, Jen sort of just said to me, like, I've been doing this work for a very long time and you weren't paying any attention. So go do it yourself. And that was like, that was probably the first time, you know, that you had ever said something like that to me, you know, even though we had, you know, obviously been talking for our whole lives and never stop. but I think that there are lots of places and spaces that we all have woken up to having to hold the pain of our own ignorance. I found it like I was holding the pain of my own ignorance or my own ignoring of something that I didn't even know I didn't know. Like that's, it doesn't even excuse the not knowing that I didn't know. Because like if I just paid more attention or I was more embodied or listening deeper, which is what you're saying, I would start to know. It's like such an interesting space. And then, you know, I think the most difficult thing is, well, how do we hold what's happening? I find this every day right now, like with, you know, pro-life, pro-choice. It's like, okay, we have to do this again. We have to fight this fight again. Like how exhausting is it for everyone to keep fighting the constant recycling of progression and I guess regression of progression constantly. It's regressing and then fighting and then regressing and then fighting. And so how collectively can we heal when no one is paying attention and not paying attention all at the exact same time? There's a huge healing that has occurred. And then from that healing, I think it widened our wound gap because we became more aware of stuff that wasn't actually being taken care of in our society.
I find it really, so one of the things working with trauma, and I work with a lot of families, I work with couples, I work with individuals, adolescents. And in, you know, there's a range, right? So some folks come in really in crisis, something has just happened or is still happening. And in some ways, if we're talking about, you know, working with folks of color, working with trans folks, we're, it is still happening, and it's not post-traumatic stress. It is active, persistent, still happening, right? We can say the same, you know, for other folks, but I want to just sort of bring that, you know, trauma into the forefront here. So what the first thing we try to do when they walk into my office is orient to some sort of quality of safety that it is so fleeting and so not guaranteed in so many places. And one of the biggest effects of trauma is that it is disorienting, right? And so we lose the directionality. We don't know sort of where, what's what, right? We don't, and so then how do we manage that? Really, this is the kind of wisdom of the body. There's lots of different responses, but one of them is to, you know, try to kind of go into a space of like safe or unsafe. And that is not necessarily a conscious thing, right? And so there's just even noticing like what makes me contract, what makes me expand. So it can be so subtle and it's obviously embodied. But I think on the collective, right, you're saying, okay, so I feel disoriented around, you know, pro-life, pro-choice, and this conversation. Sorry, I've got some alerts here. This do not disturb thing is flawed. It has its limits.
I talked Jen about do not disturb this.
This is me learning how to set boundaries. It's revolutionary. It's actually really important. Thank you, Casey.
I love you.
But the safety piece is like we have to really work from the positions that we're in to cultivate safety. And that can be through our words, through our energy, through the places where we do have power and influence. Because, you know, this is like all hands on deck. Everybody needs to be working on this, cultivating safety, creating the conditions for safety. A lot of that can be about listening, right?
Yeah.
I'm not on social media. They have made me, my colleagues have made me, you know, it's happening. They're creating a page for me, but it's really hard for me to authentically connect in that space. I recognize that we are living in an era where that is a place to exist. And so I appreciate that value, but what I do kind of throughout the day is try to create help people create safety in their own lives, you know, certainly in my office, in their relationships, and then obviously within my own people.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've ever described it. I mean, these are just our conversations generally, just so everybody knows, because now I'm like, oh, okay. I've never thought of trauma as, of course we think of it as disorienting, but then thinking about how every transition in like our life, like I'm thinking about, okay, like postpartum right now with Penelope, like there's certain places in my like life, my marriage, my friendships and my work identity that I feel disoriented and I feel less secure, which is creating anxiety at low levels for me, even though I'm probably much more calm, present, listening, and happy. There's still the disorienting experience of a transition. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if I've ever thought of trauma like that specifically. Like, okay, like, well, if trauma is anything that makes you feel disembodied, disoriented, then there are a lot of things that happen, and we don't have to necessarily think every transition, you know, is like that, because it's not. But when you have a bigger window to hold it, then you have like it that is our growth. I mean, that is our growth. So when we go back to self-care, because that's really what our topic was supposed to be, but Jen and I will never stay on one specific topic because that's just not how we go. But who cares about supposed to? I was thinking like, okay, so then we could we both want to redefine this idea of self-care, because I just think it's like the word blessed. Like, you know, people define they're blessed by like everything that's external. It's like, okay, well, why don't we, I remember when we were in college, I won't forget where I was, I promise. I remember that when we were in college, you used to do like, you would pray, you know, Jen and I, we met, and, you know, I was just like rambunctious, rebellious, but thoughtful person. And, you know, Jen was going in a good way, but going to Bible study. And I was like, what's Bible study? You know, here I am, like her Jewish friend, like, what's happening? What do you mean you're going to Bible study? You know? And, you know, friendship form done.
And I'd get with you too. So
that way
I would also be getting really drunk with you as well.
Obviously, that's true. Yeah. She was wild. We became a little wild, but the, you know, I think that Jen would tell me like, okay, at night, I do like gratitude for like every, like, even when you were in college, you were doing gratitude for like everything and everybody in your life. You know, the other night I was before I put Penelope into her swaddle, we do now like gratitude. And every time I think of you, cause I'm like, okay, this is like setting the stage of like appreciation, you know, not for just the things that are external, but like, I do like, we're grateful for our eyesight. We're grateful for our hearing. We're grateful for our moving legs. We're grateful for, you know, like our warm house. Like there's like, it's right in front of our faces, what we are blessed with. So society has, what I'm saying is, butchered the concept of blessed, you know, and just like society, and in my opinion, of course, it's my opinion, has butchered self-care into like this really sort of, the reason people are confused, why is it selfish to have self-care, is because the way that society has been using it is in more of a selfish way. Mm-hmm. And so it's, I've never thought of this. And of course this may be, I don't know, maybe it doesn't resonate as much, but self-care is anything that establishes a space of safety for you so that you are less disoriented. Because that's sort of like right now, and being a new mom, it's like, okay, well, where are the places where I can be less disoriented so that I can then orient and be conscious to be more available to listen? So then it's not a behavior. It's not a thing you're doing. It's anything that then we define as creating safety. I've never thought about like that until you mentioned that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so the orienting to safety, just at a very basic level, can begin to just regulate the nervous system and get us more into a kind of parasympathetic restful state, and like bring down the heart rate, reduce muscular tension, expand the breath. And so automatically, like, there's more space, you know, if we are oriented. So when folks come into my office, often I'll invite them into, you know, looking around the office, orienting to the windows, to the door, to me, to my voice, maybe to a lame joke, or like, you know, just trying to kind of bring them into their own somatic embodied experience of safety and location, right? Mm-hmm. It used to be mm-hmm. like, you know, in terms of our ancestors, and the threat was, you know, often, right, the tiger, or the, we talk about it in terms of, you know, the physical threats. And obviously, again, depending on positionality, some folks are experiencing physical threats all the time as well. And mm-hmm. we have also, right, you know, when we talk about mental health, a lot of times the threat isn't, you know, there is also a threat around emotional safety, and a quality of just, you know, am I safe here with you? Am I safe here with my story? Am I safe here being me? Is all of me able to be seen, right? Mm-hmm. So all of this is, you know, a process of orienting, reorienting. And there is a pace to it. There's a quality that is, I keep saying it, it's slow because our bodies really kind of need time. And we're talking about, again, not just the trauma or the stress or the pressure of this moment, but we're talking about cumulative, and we're talking about collective, we're talking about ancestral healing, right? Mm-hmm. So it's mm-hmm. a slow mm-hmm. process. Yeah.
There's an article Adam had sent me. It was like, what, you know, what's the defining thing that the most important choice you make as a parent? That was what the article was about. Mm-hmm. And it was mm-hmm. saying that where the location you live in and the other adults you surround your child with have one of mm-hmm. the biggest impacts on, you know, your child's development. And it's interesting because they were saying that a lot of the issues we have are genetic, like more genetic than you think, because it affects us in a cellular level. And one of, you know, when we, our own version of self-care, I go back to like, okay, well, what have I inherited? I inherited anxiety. My family is like riddled with anxiety. So what are the self-care practices that counter that fast moving pace of anxiety? What are the things that bring me into who I am? Mm-hmm. And when we were talking a little bit about sobriety, but I realized that even when we were in college, I remember thinking this, that's when I stopped smoking weed. Cause I felt like, mm-hmm. this is why I think now the weed industry is, I have so many thoughts on that, but whatever, can't even start there, but you know, it became a disembodied experience. And I was like, oh, I already feel disembodied. I don't need more disembodiment. Thank you so much. But like, no, thank you. And I think that alcohol, we've been fed this idea that alcohol helps us embody. It helps us be in the moment more freely. Mm-hmm. But actually, I have found also that it, again, whether you drink or don't drink, like I would still say that I would have a beer. Like, it's not about alcohol as a thing. It's about like the messages we've been given. And that's a theme that I think through mm-hmm. self-care, we have to use practices so that we can comb through those messages. And if our choices are thoughtful and slow and we've listened, then we're mm-hmm. practicing self-care, whatever that behavior is. I think we've coined it as a behavior, but it's not.
If I had to sort of reframe, I think that was, you asked me to do reframe self-care.
Yeah.
Yes. There's
of our podcast.
I would talk about a couple of things. One is spaciousness, right? So safety and spaciousness. Another piece of it is kindness. And that is like, when we are jam packed with responsibilities and, you know, capitalism and all of the sort of dynamics that keep us in a high speed chase for, you know, the next thing, just being kind to yourself and the person, you know, that's cutting you off in traffic or whatever it is. I mean, that in and of itself to me is self-care, which I really am thinking about more as collective care. Like there is a spaciousness, there is a kindness, you know, talking about stillness or like slowing down. And the thing that's like radical, if I there's a quality that's like, okay, everything feels gentle. And then there's this like sort of intensity. If I can bring that intensity, it's really around love, you know, because if we are, so the self-love, right, rather than self-care, that more radical love is like, and you and I both as moms of young ones, it's like, there's something like fierce about mm-hmm. love that can bring us, that mobilizes us, that brings us into a change, right? And the part that I feel like I'm trying to kind of let myself be aggressive about is like how I'm loving myself and you know, really anyone and everyone who's interested in the liberation of all people. I'm all about it. That to me is a collective care, which is yes, self-care too, right? I full circle here, and I have a patient coming in a moment, but I actually think the best way to orient, maybe this is for another podcast, Casey, is actually around friendship, like, because I think
let's talk about it.
But I think it's a place where we can sort of, many of us have sort of healthier experiences of being a good friend, right? Or we just have more practice, more reps around friendship and that type of love, sometimes within partnership or sexual relationships or family relationships. There's a messiness, or there's, you know, and not to say friendship is always clean, but I do think there's, you know, it's worth exploring that maybe around how friendship can help us, you know, in this orientation of
Love that
self-care. Yeah,
that'll be our next one next month. Okay, I love next you. Month.
Love
Thank you.
Thank you
for sharing your wisdom. Thank you for taking your time. I hope that all the citizen people can hear you more often.
Sure. Thank you for everything you do for all citizens, all of us.